Good to be with you.
Let's actually begin, shall we? And let's do that with breathing together. Again, an invitation to this. If this isn't the space you're in, or if the kids are bouncing off the walls, or if you just got a phone call that has you utterly distracted from the rest of life, or whatever's going on in your space, if you're able and inclined, I want to welcome you to be part of this. And what I'd like us to do this morning, if we're participating, is just stop and attend to one thing. It doesn't matter what it is. Generally speaking, the way we're wired up as humans, it helps if it's an object. Judy touched on this. We attach meaning to objects. And as we'll talk about later this morning, we also enter meaning through objects. And so just attending to the particular, this is a bit mysterious in itself, but anyone who meditates has probably encountered this. Attending to the particular opens us to other things, because it helps us to be present. So that's what I want to invite us to this morning, is just a minute or two. I won't let this go on too long, because unless we practice it regularly, most of us can't let this go on too long. But just for a minute or so, I want you to pick one object and just attend to that object. If you want to take a moment to go get something, do that. That might be something that's already in your space. For me, that will be the case this morning. The object is already in my space. But we will be still for a minute and attend. If breathing is part of your practice and you want to bring those two together, by all means. All right? One thing. Here we go. Peace, everybody. I'll have to find my way back. All right. If this is a space that you frequent, you will know that I prefer to start out each week with a different, and I hope thought-provoking, way of reminding us all that in this part of the world, we're gathering on Treaty 1 territory, that we are parties to that treaty. We're not just lumps on a certain chunk of land. We are by descent, regardless of who we are. If we think of ourselves as part of those that belong here, we are parties to that treaty. That is both a difficult to dispute historic fact and a complex cultural and social reality, and it speaks to both the specific histories that have unfolded right here and to wider issues of things like injustice and cruelty and attempted genocide. And these, of course, are issues that are not constrained to the particular details of what has happened here. When I was writing this, I had originally written, sadly, not constrained. But then I thought better of it, because even if what happened here was the only place that story was true, it would be sad enough. So, yeah. The point is, ethnically motivated hatred both happened here, and it's not limited to that history or to this piece of land, to this territory. It was then, and it's now, and it's everywhere. Now, understanding this that way, or holding that perspective, is one of the reasons why, if we're passionate about working for human rights in general, and perhaps for equality in particular, we might say that there is no peace until everyone knows peace. Not an unfamiliar slogan. In the general spirit of Advent, the attitude of doing the work of waiting that we considered last week, perhaps we could think of this season as one where we're reminded of the importance of both waiting and working for whatever goodness we want or hope to see in the world, including big things like equality or justice. If you were around for the talkie bit last week, you might remember that I mentioned Advent as yet another way that marketers have used to pave the on-ramp to December 25th. Just in case you thought that was unduly cynical, here's a news story from this past week for our consideration. By the way, I was recently reminded by part of the content of Obama's speech at the most recent global climate conference that, quote, cynicism is the path of cowards. It's a too easy bailout in the face of daunting complexities, and it does little good. And that's even knowing that, though, that's cynicism is still a path that I'm sometimes inclined to take. I do know better, and I still do it, and I'm glad when thoughtful voices call me to better ways. In any case, here's the story. So this was in the news this past week. You might have seen the story. The luxury brand Chanel got themselves into a little bit of a media storm when some social influencer or other unboxed their recently released Advent calendar product. Oh man, there are so many ways that we could explore this. It's just problematic on levels that are well beyond the content of the news item itself. In any case, there are a couple of features to the story that are relevant to what we're on about today. So the item itself is shaped like a giant cardboard perfume bottle. It has these little drawers in it, one for each day for the calendar, and you pull open that day's drawer and you get the item inside. Well, so far, perhaps so familiar. Here's the sentence from the CBC article on this that caught my attention. Quote, unlike traditional Advent calendars, which start on December 1st and are followed by new treats to be discovered every day for the next 24 leading up to Christmas Day, Chanel's starts on day 5 as a nod to the brand's iconic fragrance, Chanel No. 5. Close quote. So Chanel put all of this together as an homage to the fact that 2021 is the 100th anniversary of their famous Chanel No. 5 perfume, and that's why the calendar, their calendar product starts on day 5. That's not the part that stopped me. It was the part that described, quote, traditional Advent calendars as those containing new treats to be discovered every day. Tradition, if that sentence is to be taken at face value, I would say has both a short memory and a strong consumerist bent. There was a moment for me when I first read this story, which made the news because there was, you know, significant online pushback about the product, where I thought, you know, maybe we haven't lost our collective perspective entirely. But that was before I realized that the objections, the online objections, were about the monetary value of the stuff in the box. Okay, so the Chanel Advent calendar retails for $1,025. That I did not misspeak. Okay. And someone did the math and they felt like the stuff inside wasn't worth that much. That was the central offense. That's what got the media storm going. It wasn't the fact that a product like that, by its very structure, reinforces the idea that this entire season is about conspicuous, continuous consumption. And it wasn't about the price itself. It wasn't about that $1,000 plus price tag. It was just about the fact that the stuff inside should have been worth more. The whole thing, I mean, I'm kind of chuckling about it now, but when I read it, I just felt sad. The whole thing just struck me as very, very sad. It's this remarkable consumeristic dumbing down of the possible good that might accrue to us as persons if we are willing to sit with some of the more challenging things that a season like Advent can speak to. We could grow, folks. Like we could expand. We could deepen. We could change. But that won't happen if we take an opportunity, perhaps one like Advent, and we choke it to death on trinkets. All right. That's as close as I get to a diatribe. Here's another Advent story, one that takes us into very different terrain. So just a couple of weeks ago, right before the first Sunday of Advent, a painting depicting Mary cradling the body of the crucified Jesus was stolen from the wall outside the Mary Mirror of Justice Chapel at the Catholic University of America Law School in Columbus, Ohio. That's a mouthful, isn't it? The Mary Mirror of Justice Chapel. It's the name of the chapel inside this university. The painting itself was by a contemporary St. Louis-based artist named Kelly Latimer, and we'll hear more about and from Kelly as we go. But first about this painting a little bit. Works of art depicting Mary holding the dead body of Jesus are plentiful. They tend to reference in their structure, they tend to reference Michelangelo's famous Pietà sculpture that depicts that same scene. I've had occasion to see that work, and it is a compelling piece of work. Among its noteworthy features is its whiteness. Now, we could say that it's white because it's marble, and that's the color of the medium. But that won't quite do, because the sculptors of that era had lots of ways to bring dark colors to their work if they wanted to. No, Jesus and Mary are white because they are European. They look like the artist and the people the artist came from. This painting, the one that got stolen, by way of contrast, depicts both Mary and Jesus as brown-skinned. And the features on the Jesus figure look a lot like George Floyd. This, says the artist Kelly Latimer, is deliberate. And it's the reason the painting was stolen. When the university put the painting up, they said they did so to, quote, build on campus a culture that engages in thoughtful dialogue and debate, not the sort of bully tactics epitomized by this theft. So obviously that's a statement released in response to the theft. Shortly before, shortly after they put it up, an article critical of that choice, a particular piece of art and its location, was published by the Daily Signal, which is a website that's owned and operated by the Conservative Heritage Foundation think tank. And that was followed by an online petition which claimed to be from Catholic University of America students. The veracity of that claim is open to debate. Anyway, that petition quickly gathered more than 4,500 signatures, and then that was followed by the theft of the painting. I would say to their credit, the university administration promptly replaced the stolen painting with a smaller copy of the same work. The painting is called Mama, which is a deliberate reference to something deeply intersectional, in this case, that space shared by mothers whose sons have been killed by militarized oppressors. And also some of the final words uttered by George Floyd as he was choked to death under the knee of a police officer. The painting and much of Latimer's work is done in the style of iconography. Judy referenced a wider idea of making, vesting objects with meaning, of making them icons, if you will. Iconography is a particular stylistic sort of category. And I'm not going to get into any of the particulars of the style, but when I put a copy of the painting up later on our Facebook page, you may well look at it and have this feeling of, oh yes, I've seen works with those visual features before. It's a quite distinct style. It's rooted in Byzantine and other Eastern Christian churches. And the historic intent of these paintings is that they were to be used as aids to devotion. Now, the risk of saying something terribly obvious, devotion is not an exclusively religious thing. We can be devoted to whatever. But devotion, whatever it may be to, is something that tends to need cultivating. It's a bit fragile. It's a bit elusive. There is always something else that might be attended to, that might be resourced, that might be focused on. A few years ago when I was working with the recording artist Steve Bell, whom I worked with for several years, part of what I did for Steve on was some design work, and I designed an album for them that has the same title. It's just simply called Devotion. And when we were looking for appropriate cover art, the photograph that I sourced that Steve felt was resonant and that ended up on the cover was a guy chasing his hat down the street in the wind. Devotion. There's always something else to be attended to. There's something else to be resourced, focused on. There's distractions. There are things that that keep feel like they keep sending the object of our devotion, the focus of our devotion, out of reach. So we often need a bit of help attending to whatever we're devoted to or whatever we wish to be more devoted to. Now, in some parts of Christian practice, particularly those grounded in the Eastern Christian churches, icons were one thing that occupied that space. Most of us at the table didn't grow up in those traditions. If we grew up Catholic, perhaps Anglican, certainly if we grew up Greek Orthodox, I'm not aware of anyone in our community that did, but that might just be missing information for me. But if we grew up in some of those traditions, which Judy referenced broadly as high church traditions this morning, then we might have encountered some sort of meaningful expressions of this. But but if we grew up Protestant evangelical, or maybe more particularly Mennonite, there was not an icon in sight. we might have even grown up being taught that those things were idols, you know, like graven images, to use First Testament or Old Testament language. These things that were forbidden to the Hebrew people in their practice, and subsequently sort of spilled over into Christian practice, because we might end up worshiping the object itself rather than, you know, than the one true God, to use the language of the tradition, right? Now, for the Hebrew people, of course, they were part of a pluralistic society. They were part of a society with lots of gods, a pantheon of gods, and you could sort of pick and choose. You could have several, but they were, as a tribe, committed to this idea of God as one. And so, in some ways, when you look at it through that lens, you can sort of see how the people who were trying to give direction, spiritual direction, to this tribe would say, no images, because that's what everybody else does, and we're different. We're us. This is our distinctive, this idea of one and no objects. Having said that, they found some pretty great ways to make objects for their devotion, not least of all, you know, gigantic things like temples. Which brings me to the irony of growing up in a tradition with no icons, because my goodness, we built enormous meaning vested objects in our tradition, and we were just as prone to lose our grip on the divine because we were so occupied with church building, for example, physical churches and ministry buildings and blah blah blah, that you know, we had the same problem. It just had a different shape, right? So in any case, the Eastern Christian traditions are not unaware of this inclination that we have to stop too soon in our spiritual explorations, to basically get hung up on the parts of it that we make instead of looking further, instead of going deeper, instead of going beyond ourselves and our objects. And that is why there is, if you dig even a little bit into that Orthodox tradition in particular, there is an explicit understanding within the tradition that icons like this painting are meant to be looked through. They are meant to be windows that open into mystery. Now, in a story like the one about this particular painting, about Mama, it's easy to see the problematic way that icons, which could do so much to stir our imaginations and to provoke us to entertain ideas or explore well beyond the terrain in which we find ourselves feeling more comfortable, often serve to do just the opposite. We see them, we decide how they fit our already in place beliefs, and we proceed accordingly. If they're irrelevant within that framework, we ignore them. If they resonate, we might celebrate them or use them as the phrase that we've been using, as aids to devotion. Or if they offend us, we might shrug them off as inconsequential. We might protest their existence. We might even, you know, rip them off the wall and disappear them. Now, whatever we might make of the particular events and attitudes and perspectives surrounding them, I think there is also something here about how a season like Advent calls us to swim out past the shallows of consumerism, past the new treats for everyday kind of thinking, and into the deeper water of contemplating who we are as people, both individually and collectively. I think there is a call here to consider what good things we might be devoted to, what good things we might choose to focus on, to give our time, energy, passion, resources to. When it comes to considering what we are willing to be devoted to and how we might cultivate that devotion, and remember, I'm thinking about this as a big, big funnel of possibilities, okay? I'm not talking here about exclusive religious devotion within the frameworks we've been handed. Perhaps that's where we end up, but certainly not a given, all right? So when we think about that, when we think about what we're willing to be devoted to and how we might cultivate that devotion or those devotions, I think we might be well served by the words of Kelly Latimer, the artist who made this painting, and many others in a similar vein and style. If you do look up their work, there's quite a variety of iconography on their site, including an interesting one of Mr. Rogers. Anyway, that might make a little more sense if you spend a bit more time with the artist, which we get to do here for just a few moments. So this is Kelly Latimer's description of their own journey to painting icons. Kelly writes, "I started painting icons in 2011 Well, I was a member of the Common Friars. That's a particular group from 2009 to 2013. Our collective work was about being more connected to ourselves, each other, our surrounding community, and the land. This manifested itself as a place called the Good Earth Farm, where we held weekly services and meals and grew produce for our community and local food pantries. So that's what this community did. That was their shared life and practice, was this farm. My friend and fellow farmer Paul often posed the question, how do we become people who, in Jesus' words, consider the lilies of the field? This became the focus of my first attempt at an icon entitled, Christ Consider the Lilies. Iconography has since become a practice of more considerations. So one of the things that drew me to this person's explanation was this sense of expanding. Iconography has since become a practice of more considerations, of color and light, of brush stroke and form, symbol and meaning. I am trying to become a better painter. However, I do not wish to approach iconography as an art form that simply follows an inherited tradition, knowledge, and practice. I would say, listen to this. I want it to be a creative process, meditation, and practice that brings about new self-knowledge for the viewer and myself. Who are the saints that are among us here and now? I feel the need for new images. In some icons, I wish to embrace the traditional forms and image, but for many icons, the image needs reshaping, reimagining, and re-wondering. There are icons here that people may find theologically unsound and wrong, or for others, helpful and inspiring. I think both reactions are important. My hope is that these icons do what all art can potentially do, which is to create more dialogue. By transcending our biases, listening and having inner silence about our convictions, our inherited traditions, or our favorite ideas, we can become open to the patterns of work, knowledge, and experience we may not have seen in the other or buried in ourselves. Listen to that. By transcending our biases, listening and having inner silence about our convictions, our inherited traditions, or our favorite ideas, we can become open to the patterns of work, knowledge, and experience we may not have seen in the other or have buried in ourselves. The other may have something to teach us about what we know, about who God is, the world we live in, and who are our neighbors. This is the real work of being human and of art. Being more present. It is an ongoing journey of spirituality, craft, and considering lilies. Kelly. There's lots in there. I think we can fairly call the Chanel Advent Calendar an icon, an aid to devotion. If we want to set that idea into religious language, which we may or may not wish to do, I'm going to do it. If we want to do such a thing, I would say that that Advent calendar is an excellent devotional aid if the altar that we want to keep worshiping at is consumerism. Every day we get a little help. That is an interesting contrast to an icon like Mama that might help us consider, I would say, much more substantial life and world-altering questions as we barrel along toward Christmas. I'm going to leave us this morning with some questions. These are starter questions, as always, not last word. I would encourage you to add your own. My hope is that, as with the rest of this talkie bit or any talkie bit that I'm responsible for, that these might just be a bit of a catalyst for helping us to continue to explore what we believe. Perhaps it would be an interesting practice to choose just one of these or some other question we come up with and attend to it, just to that question, just to one thing, for 1 or 2 clear minutes each day this week. Just put everything else aside. Be somewhere where you can be physically comfortable. Sit down, rest your hands, take a few deep cleansing breaths, and just attend to one question for a minute or two. Some starters. What am I devoted to? Am I devoted to anything? Is what I'm devoted to good? What are my aids to devotion? To expand that a little bit, we might ask, what are my creative processes? What are my meditations? What are my practices? And do they help me see a greater beauty? Perhaps we would say the beauty of the divine or the beauty of love in others and in the world. Do they help me be present to what I'm devoted to? Do they help me to see the patterns of my own belief, the way those things work or don't work? Do they help me see the patterns of other people's beliefs in those same kinds of ways? And as I get more clarity out of some of that attending to those questions, I think a fairly logical follow-up question might be, is this a path on which I want to continue? If so, what might aid me in continuing? If not, what might aid me in leaving this path and taking another? I'm going to leave it there. I'll put up the picture here in just a bit on the Facebook page, and perhaps that'll help to give some shape and form to some of these ideas, and perhaps just attending to that painting itself might be your aid to devotion this week, depending on what you're devoted to and what sort of things you find helpful. Peace, everybody.